Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt. Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood receiver pressure increases.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Only Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
And welcome to Steve's Video Store, our first live show of the year, because tomorrow night is going to be pre-recorded. And with us tonight is Mr. Hot Chocolate himself, Carl Kafer.
Greetings, salutations. Nice to be here with you, Stephen. I appreciate it.
You bring it in, everybody?
Well, I have my hot chocolate. My cheese is already eaten.
Hot chocolate for everybody.
Yes, actually, yes. I can make you some right now. Not a problem.
We'll talk about the next move tomorrow night, but
hate to say this, Stephen, but you are definitely breaking up.
Yeah.
I can cover for you because I'm not hearing anything.
Okay, I'll be back in a second, everybody. While I'm gone, tell everybody what you got planned for Friday.
Okay, fair enough. On Deviant Legion Network, we have a show tonight. Doc is doing a show. You can listen to that later. But also, on Friday, I am planning to do a show about one of my favorite things in the world, and that would be cheese. No, I'm not talking about cheesy movies. I'm not talking about cheesy comic strips or anything like that. I'm talking real, honest-to-God cheese and all of its wondrous forms. And so we will have Phoebe with us, and hopefully a lot of call-in. I'll have it posted up later in the week. So that's what we're going to do. And Stephen has something very special planned today. We're going to be talking about Tempe Entertainment, which is one of the video distributors back in the 80s and 90s. We just found out that after all these years, they're going to be going out of business. And this is our Stephen's podcast in remembrance of Tempe Video. So as soon as Stephen gets back, we will be starting that, and we've got some guests. Stephen, is that you?
Yeah.
There he is.
Tim was here with you.
Okay.
Hello, Tim.
Hello. How's it going today?
Yeah. All right. Carl, two facts that came out since yesterday when we recorded the New Year's Eve show. One, Holmes and Watson is getting records in the amount of just walking out from it.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, I've heard it's really bad. So bad, I don't want to see it.
Yeah. I book that day because tomorrow, pretty much, well, not pretty much, it's the last day that Walter B. is going to be in business. They're setting the doors.
JR, are you there?
No, it's Tim Ritter.
Oh,
yeah,
oh, that's Tim.
Kinda,
okay. That's
yeah,
Tim.
It's just kind of breaking up a little bit.
The first group.
Yeah, he is.
Tim was some of the first group calls that proved that you could release the movie straight to video and actually make money on it.
That is correct.
That's cool.
Way back in 1984 or 1985, in that kind of time frame.
Yeah,
now,
you started.
Studios
okay.
Are still being greedy with their titles, Carl, and none of the big titles would come out. So, like, they were like, "Hey, you want new movies? Here."
Well, it was all marketing, wasn't it? I mean, you know, you were trying to fill in a lot of genre material and that sort of thing for, you know, it was like the Wild West back then.
That is correct. It was kind of like, well, the opportunity was to get your work seen in a kind of a public way, kind of like, and at the time I was reading books on Herschel Gordon Lewis and John Waters and that sort of thing, and the way they took their movies to the midnight movies and the drive-in era, and suddenly you had videotape, which was, you know, mom-and-pop video stores where you could actually go around on your own without going through a corporate, you know, scenario where, you know, a vice president of marketing and buyers and acquisitions had to actually approve your product. You could just go in the front door, you'd meet the owners, and the owners would be like, "Oh yeah, we'll take that," or, "Hey, get out of the store, we would never carry that." But you could have a conversation with them, and many times they would actually put the movie on, and you'd stand there, you've written the movie, you've edited the movie, you've made the movie, you've packaged the movie, you're walking around selling the movie, and then you have to watch the movie with, you know, each individual owner as they criticize it. But you learned a lot from, you know, doing it that way, and they're like, "Well, how much is it?" That's like $25, and you know, over a period of 3 months at $2-3 a rental, if it rents five times a week, you know, they're gonna triple their money back easily. And then you go into the yearly basis. Some of the stuff on Truth or Dare, Critical Madness. I mean, a lot of these stores were making tens of thousands of dollars over a period of 3 to 5 years. Tape that they paid, you know, $60-$50 for, or $80. So it was kind of a kind of a different situation than it is, you know, now with streaming and, you know, penny per view for the creator, and, you know, that's it.
Oh, well, the creators are getting screwed. I mean, there's
Definitely.
No question about that. But back in the day, you talk about the video store and product, you know, just like streaming, unfortunately, they don't pay, but you know, this starving for product and to make your store different than the Blockbusters, things like that. I would suggest that you didn't sell so much to Blockbuster and the big chains as opposed to the small mom and pops. Would I be correct in that assumption?
Right. Well, we started out before Blockbuster existed, and what happened was, you know, we went around to the mom and pops and got some of our early projects, Day of the Reaper, Twist Illusions, and Truth or Dare, Critical Madness, in those mom and pop stores. And later what happened was Blockbuster came about. You know, and like you said, each store was like, depending on their demographic area, if they were in an area, you know, the owners knew their renters. It was a social atmosphere like the old vinyl record stores. You know, they'd come in, they'd talk to the owners, they'd recommend movies. A lot of times the owners would have similar tastes to the, you know, the renters, the customers, would go on from there. And when Blockbuster came in, they absorbed the mom and pop stores and all the tapes. As they bought them all out, all the old stuff that, you know, we had distributed got absorbed into kind of the corporate mainstream. So it was kind of an interesting, you know, circumstance as Blockbuster National Video. There was a couple other chains, Movie Galleries. There was a few more, you know, gobbled up all
Hollywood,
the
yeah.
A few years, you know. So
Movie
kind of
Gallery was the chain video store. Actually make 2, 3, 4 of their own movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't know
like,
that either.
You remember, you saw them a couple of indie films, right, Carl? The Movie Gallery or Shooting Gallery?
No, I haven't, actually.
Yeah, I don't remember them.
Yeah,
either,
they,
but there's another one called Hollywood Home Entertainment. They may have done something like this.
Yeah, Hollywood. Yeah. Hollywood, I know. I did. Basically, it was Blockbuster and Hollywood for me. The big ones,
yeah.
Generally.
Definitely. Some of them only went to like 30 states or, you know, like in the Midwest or the South. Or again, very similar to the Ivins and the, you know, movie theater chains at a certain point. It kind of really echoed that when you look back on it now.
Mm-hmm. I start when we talked before, when you try to get your dad to invest in video stores, back when you would have 3 or 4 little video stores in the town, and they would try to compete to have the most titles as anyone else.
Or if a mom and pop were smart, they would do completely different titles that you couldn't find at the, you know, Blockbuster had their rules. So if you wanted
right.
some real horror. Extreme horror or things like that, or good porn or whatever the case would be, your mom and pops.
Yeah.
That would be right.
Truth of Dare was weird, Carl, because it was the first shot of video films. They actually get great reviews on Fangoria in the bigger magazines. Unlike
yeah.
stuff like Blood Call, The Ripper with Tom Savini, Forever Evil, which is the one title of all the SOV ones, that if I could get the negative
right.
in every copy of it and burn it, I'd make the world a better place.
Yeah, those were our competitors or people releasing the, you know, same type of thing at the same time. And, yeah, I think it was Blood Cult, Revenge, Terror, a Ten Killer. I remember that one. And then the one you were talking about. There was a few of them. They were doing it for the money. You know, they weren't really passionate horror fans that I'm aware of. And once it started to dry up a little bit and they sold X amount of tapes, they kind of just zoomed on to the next. Sad, and a lot of them just kind of disbanded, it seemed.
Yeah. But that's what called Carl. Imagine them shooting an 80s slasher, but not
okay.
investing in a lighting kit.
Yeah. I don't remember it
yeah,
being dark.
Yeah, DIYs, man. You get some bad ones, but then again, you get some good ones too. I mean, you know, it depends. It's a crapshoot sometimes.
That is
and I
true,
think
and
nowadays,
also...
where they watch like a Netflix movie and flip it on and off in 5 seconds, back then,
yeah,
if you
well,
went into the movie, even
minutes.
If it was for $1, you watch sucker all the way through because you had no choice.
Right, you had time and money and gas invested, and you picked it out off the shelf and probably talked to the owner about it, and a whole slew of things.
Yeah, but I can tell you, back in those days, now I didn't do a lot of renting. I started out in the drive-in in the 70s, so that's how I got to know my cult stuff. But I mean, I would run across some bad ones like, nah, I'm not wasting my time. It goes back. I'm sorry, I was one of those.
Well, yes, he was first trying to be my professional company and not just sell their stuff on the back pages of Fangoria and pop stores.
Yeah. Yeah, you are breaking up again. I hate to say that.
You're breaking up, Scotty. You're breaking up.
You're breaking up. I can't hold it together.
I'm giving it all she's got, but it's still breaking. You got some storms up there or something? Or
mm-hmm.
I
think he's
weather.
Trying to call back again. He has some difficulties sometimes with Usenet. Usenet will never have an advertisement on this show. Trust me.
So you started in the drive-in era, huh? Where you actually ran the drive-in?
So my folks ran a music store. One of our customers was the projectionist at the local drive-in. It was Limestone, New York, and right across the border from us. We were in Bradford, Pennsylvania. And so he said, hey, I could use someone to put reels together in that. How about you? I was like 14 years old, and he talked my dad into it. And like the second week, it was like Blood Freak, all this like boobs and gore, and I just fell in love. So yeah, I grew up driving, and then we had HBO that gave me a bunch of stuff too. And then I was in New York in the '80s, so.
Wow, yeah. That's pretty cool. So that means you saw the Grindhouse era and the 42nd Street and all that.
Yeah, the Grindhouse was dying. I got to New York in 1981. By 83, 84, it basically had dried up into all porn, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the drive-in and so on and so forth.
You saw
good
some
stuff.
Horror movies there, like Maniac. That's kind of the era.
Absolutely.
Pieces and all those good.
One of my favorite stories is I had a friend of mine who got hired to be a picketer at Snuff, Roberta Finley's film.
Oh, wow. Well, that's funny.
Okay. And this was, this was after it was made. I mean, this is the second run. They re-edited it, and they had the damn bus that was, or whatever the hell it was, that was riding 8th Avenue and 42nd Street with advertisements. And all these fake protesters, he got me in for free.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. A lot of people didn't like Snuff. I encountered it on this this VHS compilation tape called Film Gore. And I always loved the movie because I assume I was watching all the good parts. Because it was one of those, let's show the best of scenes. So I saw the scene at the end where the hands were cut off and the intestines were ripped out and all the weird stuff in the Amazon woods where they're all talking and everything. So I probably saw all the like best moments of that movie. And it was probably,
yeah.
I assume, the reason.
Film Gore was Charles Band.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been. It was a thing called Film Gore, and that's how I saw it.
Yeah,
probably was
four
Charles
tapes Band. Like that.
Big Box.
Yeah, he
classic,
put out four tapes like that. Film Gore,
Best of Sex
and Violence with the Carradines, Zombie Son, and Famous TNA, which is nothing but nudie scenes of the famous stars when they did the B movies.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't see that one. Didn't know we were.
I need to get me a copy of that one.
That sounds like I missed the best one, right?
Yeah, really?
No, Sex and Violence, the stuff with Robert, it's got like John, Robert, and Dave, and who's the one in Nashville, Carl? David?
Keith.
And
oh,
Keith
like
Carradine.
Cameron Mitchell. Cameron Mitchell was in a couple of them.
Yeah. They were just on the set goofing around. Like there's one scene in it where they're introducing car crash movies, and David asks John if he could borrow the car.
Oh,
nice.
Wow.
And he's like, "No, you can't borrow the car. You crashed it last time."
Well, he got himself a good car in a Death Race 2000, so he did just fine.
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
But that's the kind of stuff that you miss, Carl. You'd see all sorts of wild crap like that where they would just film stuff and put it out on VHS and try to make a buck off of it.
Well, you know, I mean, we've had people like Chester Novell Turner on and so on and so forth. What I really admire is the chutzpah and doing it and then going to sell it individually. I mean, being a traveling salesman is not an easy job, even if you have decent product.
You know, so when you have so our product.
Yeah. Yeah, it's,
and until tomorrow night at midnight, Carl Tempe was the last of the labels from that day to still be going on and putting out new product.
Well,
wow. I didn't know they were even putting out new product. I thought they were just kind of selling the catalog. So they were actually, like, I guess, doing acquisitions and releasing stuff still.
Yeah, well, in the past 2 years, he's done like a deluxe Blu-ray of. Well, he's still got Robot Ninja coming out in February.
That is true.
You know,
how the heck is he going to distribute it without the company?
Well, I think he did a fundraiser through, you know, where everybody could pre-buy it and, you know, invest through like Indiegogo or Kickstarter. So I assume he'll go to those customers, and then probably you could list stuff on eBay, and then you could, at that point, you could take your whatever product is left, and you could, you know, sell to different sub-distributors or, you know, distributors.
You know, and couldn't he have his own Facebook page? Like Jeff Lieberman has the rights to, which one is it, Remote Control, and he sells it from his own page.
Right.
No. And Blue Sunshine, too.
Yeah, Blue Sunshine.
Yep, does. And that's the same thing that
and
I do.
And he does, and that's how we all found out about Tempe going under. He just announced 2 months ago on the Facebook page, we're going out of business.
Yeah, I don't think they were really doing that much business because, I mean, they were doing some, but, you know, the whole market has kind of shifted over to streaming quite away from you know, DVDs and Blu-rays, especially for the ultra smaller guys. It's except for, I mean, I like I said, I sell my stuff. I just buy it off the distributors and I resell it at shows. I sell stuff directly through you know, Facebook if somebody contacts me, and I got a couple of vendors who find stuff. You know, so if somebody's looking for VHS, I can find all my old stuff pretty much. So. But it's, you know, it's a very niche market. Today, most people, you know, they do the streaming thing. It's, unless it's a Star Wars movie or some kind of, you know, something like Blade Runner 2049 or whatever it is, you know, they don't really want or need a physical copy. And not a lot of people, you know, watch movies over and over and over, except for the, you know, the big tentpole movies now. There's some, you know, there's people like us. I mean, I know I watch, you know, my favorite movies over and over and over. But I think the newer generations are less inclined to do that. They'll binge watch a TV show on Netflix and they'll go, okay, you know, that's 10 hours of programming. And then they're like, well, what else can I watch now? And they've completely forgotten that other one, you know. 3 weeks later, they're like, I mean, I know people who do this that are younger in the 20s, you know, early 20s, and they can't even tell me who's in the movie or the TV show or what it was really about by the time they're watching, you know, just so much. And they're watching it all on their little teeny tiny phones, which really bugs me, too. I'm like, oh, this is the era of the 50, 75-inch television screens, et cetera, et cetera. And here's everybody, not a 13-inch black and white TV. You're talking a 3-inch screen you can hold in your hand that you got to put like right up to your eyeballs to actually see. So it's kind of progress and regress all at the same time. Right? Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
there was a movie
what
about.
Go ahead, Steve, then I'll come in. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Carl. Mine's going to be bigger. Go ahead.
Okay. One of the things about, you know, video, you know, VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, and I say this as being a record collector. It's the collectors that are going to keep that business going, okay? So
yeah.
So if you're trying to sell DVDs, Blu-rays, or even VHS, you've got to go with the real niche stuff at this point for collectors.
You
got to
have extras, poster, toys, like Shout Factory does the, you know, Silent Night, Deadly Night action.
You know, but also look at Vinegar Syndrome. Vinegar Syndrome doesn't
right.
do any of that type of packaging, but they really pull out the obscure stuff.
Right.
No, when they put out, Carl, when they put out Cutting Class for Thanksgiving, guess what the bonus was?
Well,
five,
four
five
different
covers
flip covers.
You got five
yeah,
flip covers.
Yeah, Cutting Class
with
four different flip covers. Did not
oh,
sell
God.
Out.
Yeah, they've had keychains and posters, and there was something else they did, stickers, and
yeah.
you know, they've had all kinds of extra little trinkets for the first, like, 1,000 copies, and then they'll go to, you know, just a standard
copy. But you know what it is? It's what they pick to bring out, okay? That's what I'm saying that these companies need to do. The real obscure, yep. like, someone brought out Jose Larraz's now I can't think of it. But the
Symptom.
One with yes, thank you. Thank you. And that had not been out before and just sold out like a son of a bitch. I tried to get a copy of it.
Well,
and,
here's the funny part, Carl. They put
what?
Out the big spangled edition of a Cutting Class of four slip covers.
Right.
And the only one that sold out was Mausoleum, the one with Barbie Breese. That one sold out within 3 hours.
Of course, the question is begged now, why? But that's beside the point.
Barbie Breese.
yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
And it's getting impossible for the companies to really gauge which title is going to sell and which isn't.
Right, so that's why they'll do like a minimum of 1,000, and you know they'll say limited edition. When these are sold out, that's it for this version, and you know they just put them as many as they can. But it's interesting that it is like 1, 2, and 3,000 maximum on everything. So it's
well, that makes absolute sense. That makes sense. You don't want to oversaturate the market, and you don't want inventory up the yin yang. So you want to limit these releases. So, I mean, that makes absolute sense.
Oh, definitely, but it also shows that compared to the old days where you were selling like 1986, 87, when you're selling 30 to 100,000 copies, it shows how the market has shrunk as far as, you know, physical.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it ain't that time anymore. So you know, just like anything else, you have to adapt to what you're selling and you know what the delivery system is and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, in this market, the artist and the independent is getting screwed beyond belief. Understood.
Yep.
Well, like a movie that I love, The Endless. It was made, I've seen it 2 years ago, right, Carl? 2 years ago or last year. Yeah. And it didn't even get released until this July.
Yeah. It takes forever to get anything out there. I got one that I shot for an anthology movie, and the backlog is so great on release schedules that once here's like the framework. You shoot and edit a movie, and that can take like 6 months to a year from the ground floor, raising the money, writing the script, going out and filming it and editing it. Then from the time you sign with the distributor, and it can take like 5 months to sign, you know, you're looking at sometimes 18 months to 24 months before it will even be able to get a slot to come out. And then if it doesn't perform, in other words, sell X amount of copies fast enough, then it's simply a catalog title that kind of vanishes, and it's on a few websites like Amazon, Walmart. Kind of buried unless you really know what you're looking for. So it's just the way it is now.
Yeah. You don't see much obscure stuff at Walmart anymore. If you do, you better pick it up when you see it, because once it's sold out, they won't restock it.
They get like 10 copies, and once those 10 copies are gone, like SRSM had House Shark in Walmart this past summer, and when they sold out, they were Same with Bone Hill Road, the Todd Sheets movie. You know, that one. So I said, wow, they're gone if you're lucky enough to find them. So.
Yeah, I think Todd Sheets talked about how it took him 2 months just to get it restocked at Walmart from when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They only put some of the copies in circulation, and Walmart only carries some. I mean, sometimes what they'll do is, like, regional release, they'll buy, you know, say, 5,000 copies or whatever, and then take them from store to store, and if they don't sell at store A, then they'll just move them, you know, to another store. Because, of course, they have so many stores right now currently. You know, you can probably find one every few miles in most big cities and such.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Todd Sheets, had him on our podcast. And the interesting thing is with Colnado, you know, he's still trying to work out distribution on that. I actually helped one of his co-stars learn Latin for that film, so it was kind of fun.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
But, yeah, I mean, Tempe was the first really big attempt for the indie guy, and well, Book Walter, who made The Dead Next Door, to really try to start a company for the indie guys. Troma has always called herself indie. But it's always been known that selling a movie to Troma is sort of like anal rape without a hug and a kiss.
In other words, there's no pay, right?
Yeah. Well, in the second book, Trey Parker and Matt Stone talk about how they sold Cannibal to the musical to Troma, and they only got they got basically their budget back. And they said, how much are we going to get off the tapes in the back end? He's like, oh, there'll be no, this is it. You're getting this flat payment. Because by the time our production cost and all that, we're losing money.
Yeah. Yeah, they're interesting. I had a deal with them for Killing Spree when we first finished it. And we went round and round. Basically, they offered me like at first they said, we're going to give you $30,000 up front, and then we're going to, you know, blow it up to 35 millimeter and blah, 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 and then get it out and do this and do that. But then it said, then it turned around was that they were going to take the $30,000 advance they were allegedly going to give me, put that into all the post-production work, so you'd get nothing up front, and then, of course, nothing thereafter. So we ended up not going with them. They lost one of my sound reels, too, because they were like, well, we were close to signing, and I sent them the material, and the guy I was dealing with, he just kind of left or got fired or something. And it was kind of an experience there.
Yeah, that's unfortunate that there are these companies that will screw you know. But that's true. You got to be careful at who you deal with.
That's true.
Yeah, during the DVD era, it seemed like Troma was buying every little 10-cent piece of crap movie they could just to build their catalog up.
Yeah, they have a pretty extensive catalog now beyond, you know, their own titles. I think they're still producing their own titles.
Class of Nukem High Part 2, which isn't done. And they're filming another Shakespeare type film, which isn't done.
Oh, so they're
We've been waiting for the second half of Class of Nukem High, the remake, for about 4 years now, Carl. Has it been since the first part's been out?
I think it's like three, but yeah, it's been a long time.
Wow. Yeah, I heard they were doing it, but I just hadn't been able to keep up, so that's pretty bad, though.
Well, if you watch the first part, it looks like he overshot the hell out of it, so they had to bust it into two movies, doesn't it, Carl?
Oh, good God.
Because
nothing happens.
Nothing. It's like the first 10 minutes of the original only takes place, and it takes place in 90 minutes of screen time.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, pacing, bad, bad pacing in the corner, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's sad how the indie guys really can't make it anymore. You get them, they go in there wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, they make the best movie they can, and then they can't come out of the distributing system looking like they have just seen the most horrible thing in the world.
Well, you know, it seems to me, you know, we're talking about Tempe and they're going out, and that's very unfortunate. But now that we've got streaming, you know, you've got Shudder, which seems to be a very, very good streaming service. Now, I don't know how they handle their you know, their product and that. But why not make a Tempe distribution streaming service?
Or something where he kind of hinted that he might do that. So he said this may not be the last hurrah for, you know, the material here. And the company that my stuff, you know, that has my stuff, SRS Cinema, they have their own whole paper stream website through Vimeo. I mean,
Is that Ron Bonk?
Yes.
Is that Ron Bonk and Howard Romero? They're good people.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I've been working with Ron since he came, you know, since he started up. So.
Well, yeah, Something Weird Video tried to have its own streaming service. It went under. Vinegar Syndrome had their own streaming service, and it went under.
Right.
Now Something Weird Video is selling all of its streaming rights to Charles Band's Full Moon streaming service.
Yeah, the whole thing's gotten so competitive. And the problem is, if you like certain things, you know, certain products, say you like Disney, say you like Roma, say you like this, say you like that, it's getting to be so, you know, everything has got its own company that's wanting to release its own thing. So pretty soon you're going to have to pay like $200 a month to get, you know, all the, you know, if you like Star Trek, you got to subscribe to Paramount. If you like Star Wars, you're going to have to subscribe to Disney streaming service. If you like Vinegar Syndrome and all these others, you know, they're going to have their own thing. So
thing. The independents, the small guys, the Vinegar Syndromes, you know, why not do a little conglomerate? Why not be sisters and support each other? That's the way to go, as far as I'm concerned.
They were. They had a lot of product on their exploitation site that you know, wasn't, that they just kind of acquired to run on the streaming service. But for some reason, I don't know why. I guess they just didn't get enough subscribers for it. And I had it for a while. I don't think they didn't rotate the titles and add a lot of new ones. They saw it as kind of competition for the Blu-ray and stuff that they were releasing. But I do know that a lot of it does end up on Amazon streaming, Prime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I see a lot of people of the collectors like us that were like, they're putting out a new HD print of Truth or Dare. I don't know if I'm going to buy that. And then they go, let's say Shudder had it. And then they went and seen it like, wow, this is the best this movie ever looked. I'm getting the Blu-ray.
Yeah, that sometimes happens, definitely. I do that myself.
Yeah, it's you know, with the change in delivery system, you know, you have to adapt. You can't be doing the same thing. And so many companies don't understand that. You know, it's a shame. But hopefully Tempe will reinvent itself. That would be a very good thing, I think.
Yeah.
Well, if Bunk Walter's able to slant. Yeah. Well, I'll say as long as he stayed in the business, yeah. Because during the late 90s, he filmed a lot of the later Full Moon movies like Hideous.
Right. Right. And he added in a lot of he did a lot of post production work on the Puppet Master movies and, you know, all those. So yeah, he was definitely heavily involved with Charles Band Productions then too. So then again, he may just want to kind of take a break. He could, could come back, you know.
Yeah, it, I would think it's a bug, right? Once you get the bug, you know, you can't stop doing it.
Definitely.
You might take a break, but sooner or later, you know, that little siren is going to call to you.
Right.
You know, I would say you know that very well, I would think, Tim.
Oh, yeah. I've quit all too many times. Maybe one quit. Keep right on that.
Well, it's like me and cigarettes. You know, I've quit a thousand times, then I start up again. Like
that's
5
right.
minutes later.
It's like an addiction. Really making is an addiction for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's two ways it can be. It can be like I quit, then I come back with renewed energy, or two, the Toby Hooper way. I don't care if the movie's good or not. I just want to be on the set and make a movie.
Well, his case was a little different in that I think he was usually getting paid. So the problem with
yeah,
that,
yeah, but
that,
still,
guy,
that was his. That was a direct quote
yeah.
from him. After a while, he didn't give a darn if the movie was good or not. He just wanted to be on set and filming a movie. That's what mattered to him.
Yeah. His were kind of hit and miss. I liked Eaten Alive, of course, the original Chainsaw and Chainsaw 2, and then Toolbox Murders was not the original. I liked the original better, but it holds your attention. The remake, it was okay. It wasn't too bad. And of course, Life Force. Can't argue with that one. That one is just crazy and all over the place. And what was the other one?
Yeah.
Spontaneous Combustion.
Well,
that was.
Oh, you mentioned a bad word. You said spontaneous combustion. No!
Spontaneous combustion. How can you go wrong?
That
with
movie.
Brad
Dourif. Yeah, Brad Dourif is good in it. It's just everything else is crap.
Yeah, I remember.
And it
I
makes no damn sense.
The day it came out, and it was pretty disappointing. I was like, what? What is
yeah.
this? Thank goodness he didn't have CGI back then for flames, because that's all
yeah.
it would have been.
Well, at least there was one good thing this year. Your name wasn't involved with the Blumhouse Truth or Dare movie. Ugh.
Oh, was it bad? I have not seen it.
Oh, God, yeah. It's horrible. It's about a cursed game of Truth or Dare where you have to do the dare or else this ghost demon thing will kill you.
Oh, okay. Well, there's been kind of a lot of movies with the Truth or Dare theme. It's almost like a little subgenre to its own now. I mean, there's been a ton of them. Would You Rather, the sci-fi Truth or Dare, Jessica Cameron's Truth or Dare, and then the Blumhouse Truth or Dare. And I think there was even another one. I was in Walmart, and I was like, what? Here's another Truth or Dare. It's actually pretty interesting, you know, but I have not seen many of them. I saw the Madonna Truth or Dare years ago, but...
it's a shame you don't get money from them.
Yeah. Right, yeah. We tried to kind of see how that would work out, especially if it was close to what we were doing or a slasher movie, but, you know, when it's all said and done, it's just kind of like a zombie type of thing. It's really hard to copyright as far as the game Truth or Dare, that's not mine. That's, you know, it's like Ring Around the Rosie. And
but
then you
could
have people put different spins on it.
Yeah. But you could have one, which I'm not naming the name, you probably may or not, where the person that made the film was stupid enough to brag about that they might have reused your idea in a script. That's an easier way
happens.
To.
Well, isn't that the sincerest form of flattery when somebody copies you?
No, it's called stealing.
It is, too, right?
I've had to deal with her in a horror group before. This person in a horror group before, Carl. I would to call this person the Antichrist of the sort of subgenre that she puts herself in is me being nice.
Right.
Okay.
She would get like 40 so of her fans to infiltrate the group, and any time that you would try to ban their selfless promotion, the 40 fans would gang up on you and calling you a bully.
Oh,
well, you know, I co-run ISF, Incredibly Strange Films, which is one of the largest groups on Facebook. And, you know, we've got this rule. You want to self-promote, you got to take it through us first. Otherwise, we just delete. And so many people don't even read the rule. So we delete 50 to 60 self-promotions a week, easy, like 10 a day.
Wow.
And if you ever get a chance to see Tim Ritter's Truth or Dare, people watch it. It's crazy in a good way.
Well, when you were on before, Tim, you know, I wasn't familiar with your stuff at all. You know, the DIY period was something where I had missed it. But and since that time, I have seen Truth or Dare. And there was one other. I can't think of it right now. But, yeah. You know, there are people out there that do stuff on their own, independent, who do good work. You're one of them. There's no question.
Oh, thank you. I'm just a fan doing the best that I can with, you know, the budget and the circumstances I'm put in, pretty much. So that's what we're kind of still doing now. We just finished the shoot in November and early December, and we're going to roll into some more, in the early 2019 there. So hopefully we got some more stuff coming. And I think if you're passionate about horror and the material, it really shows, even if you don't have much or any money, you know, compared to people who are like, let's make a movie. We know horror movies make a lot of money. Let's do this. Hurry up. Get it out. So,
yeah.
Which, unfortunately, it happens.
Well, look at M. Night Shyamalan. He was making mega million-dollar movies, and they pretty much weren't that good. But then he started making under $5 million movies, and he's come out like a rock star again. So,
right. Sometimes less money forces you to kind of improvise and adapt and create, you know, better stories and characters. So, as opposed
to, gives you the freedom, because the big studios nowadays are like, I'm a $4 million movie. Oh, go do what you want. We don't care about you. You're small potatoes.
Yeah, well, the $200 million ones are the ones we got our fingers in.
Well,
I don't think me and Carl could make $100 million movies. We'd go nuts.
Oh, hell no. Hell no. Give me a million. Give me a million. I'll make you a movie. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
You know, give me $750,000. I'm okay with that, too. But what I was going to say was both Stephen and I watched King Cohen, about Larry Cohen, and there is something very real about being a guerrilla filmmaker and doing it on your own and having the ability to improvise, to steal shots, to do whatever you have to do. I think it engages you more. And as a filmmaker, it can elevate the material and make it better. I really do believe that.
That is correct, I think. I think, you know, because you're completely in the, immersed in the material, and you're becoming one with the material, and you're thinking about it all the time. And like you said, you're sneaking shots here, you're trying to figure out a shortcut there, and you know, really, there's if changes have to be made, there's no committee, and you just kind of, you know, you put all of your, you know, your heart and your passion into it. And I think when it's all put together, you know, if whoever's watching and if they like that sort of thing, they're really going to pick up, you know, the effort that you made. And I think that's the people who like my stuff, I think they kind of pick up on that and go like, yeah, man, I watched it a couple times because I can see, you know, I just enjoyed it. I can feel the, you know, the passion behind the project, and it just came out, you know, really good with the circumstances that you have. They're not, nobody's saying that hey, this is better than, you know, this or that, but if you appreciate the, you know, the Vinegar Syndrome era, the, you know, the 80s direct-to-video era, and then there's the 90s era, which had some good stuff, but it was probably the lesser era because, you know, shot on video was going on.
The 90s era was too corporate.
Right, and there's the slashers were out, and it was just maybe the occasional Roger Corman strip to kill type of thing. It was the era of, like, the Basic Instinct, erotic thriller, copycats on video. And 2000 to 2010, that kind of became the era of, I don't know, I guess remakes, where, you know, suddenly Scream had ushered in 96, kind of all these newer movies like I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend. And then suddenly they got on the kick of, hey, let's remake everything. And they started to make, you know, everything from Halloween to April Fool's Day to, you know, everything that we, last thousand
yeah.
around, everything that got remade. So then now we're at a time where we're kind of a mix match. There's sequels and remakes of recent sequels. And you're just like going, you think, what? Another, wait a minute, okay, let's look at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You got the original, you got the sequel of the original, you got the third one, which is a sequel kind of to the first one because everybody died in the second one, although Leatherface just miraculously reappears in the third one. Then you got the fourth one, which is a direct sequel to the original one, and then you got the remake, and then the prequel to the remake, and now the sequel, the prequel to the original, I think, is the way it goes now. And I'm like going,
yeah. Well, now they have
like
a
Halloween.
Weird. The last one was a weird prequel that showed Leatherface as a kid growing up. And the big hook in that one is,
right,
we're not going to show you which kid turns out to be Leatherface at the end of the movie. We're making it a mystery.
Yeah, yeah, I haven't seen that one yet. That's one of the ones I've not seen because it just got so confusing, and there was already a movie called Leatherface. That was Chainsaw 3, and now it's just Leatherface. It's like, hey, we can't think of an idea, but even for a title now, let's just go ahead and call it, it's like Halloween, you know. You can't say Halloween Returns. It's like, okay, now it's just Halloween. I don't know.
Yeah, the way with Halloween, it's like, after they made 1, 2, and 3, 4 is like, 3 don't exist. And then they did 4, 5, and 6, and then 7 come along. 7 don't exist. And then then Rob Zombies come out and says, okay, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, 7 don't exist. And then we got the newest one, which is, okay, 1 exists, everything else don't exist.
Yep, exactly. So now you're like going, how am I supposed to get a box out of this and a sense out of it? It really doesn't tie
why
together
like that. Why can't I be in a universe where Halloween 3 exists and has sequels? Why is
that
not
cool.
possible?
It should be.
Yeah.
I guess because it kind of bombed when it came out because everybody was so mad that Michael Myers wasn't in it. But then it kind of gained a cult audience on TV and video. And I think it's like a big film. I mean, I mean that whole concept, you could make many sequels to that, you know, with the things
yeah,
that stole to make
Mad. I love the idea of it. Which Carpenter was going to be
cool.
Like, okay, we're going to give, it was going to be, okay, we're going to give an independent filmmaker or a new guy coming up $1 million and tell him to make a movie, but it's set place in Halloween, and it's going to have a new story every Halloween.
Right. And I think
that
would have
been
fun.
Were.
Yeah, they were going to try to
do
that
was
the
plan.
Halloween 3 and 4, and then they Carpenter, Deborah Hill sold the rights, and, you know, they took it all back to the shape with Halloween 4, so.
Yeah. The other one too for me is the, if you take a look at all of the Howling sequels, of course,
right,
most of them are horrible. But I have a great love of Howling 3, The Marsupials. I adore that movie. And I just wish that was something that had sequels too, because I love that movie, and I love the whole idea of marsupial werewolves.
Very cool.
I'm weird, by the way.
Yeah.
There's a series
what
of
it
books
was,
too.
Is,
the author that those are based on, he wrote like 4 or 5 books, you know, that were different from the movies.
Right.
But
go
three
ahead,
was Steve. Basically Ozploitation, the movie. Everything in it, if you knew Ozploitation, you would get to you. The movie would actually make sense. Like having the star of Jimmy Blacksmith walk up to a guy and go, "Put another shrimp on the bobby, you fuck."
And then there's the wondrousness of Frank Thring. Oh, God, I love him. Yeah, never mind. I'm weird.
Well, yeah, the best
be
way...
Good to be weird.
Is, are your movies still available pretty cheap on DVD, the retro 80s collection editions of Truth or Dare and Killing Spree?
Yeah, everything's still pretty widely available on Amazon. We've had so many special editions of, you know, all the old stuff, and it continues to come out. I think in 2019 we're going to be releasing Wicked Games, Truth or Dare Part 2, and Screaming for Sanity, Truth or Dare Part 3. Those will be on probably a DVD. And all the other old
nice
stuff, Killing Spree still available on Blu-ray. The original Truth or Dare is on DVD and you know, Blu-ray as well. And I'm just trying to think, Creep has a Blu-ray. Yeah, pretty much everything else is on like Amazon, Walmart. And, you know, and I've seen them in Walmart stores and the $5 bins through a distributor on MVD.
And if you guys who are 80s slasher fans haven't seen Killing Spree, you need to. It's a perfect example of how to take a normal idea, guy goes crazy because he thinks his wife is screwing it around, and then go off on a big batshit tangent in the last reel.
That's right. A little zombie.
I'm not
going to
spoil it, but Jesus Christ, do you take a severe left turn during the last reel of the film?
A little zombie. Yeah. I think that's the only zombie movie that, you know, I've made with zombies. Eventually, I'd like to do another, you know, swipe at zombies, but unfortunately, it kind of got overdone, didn't it, with Walking Dead and a zillion zombie movies later. 28 years later.
When you have MILFs versus zombies, it's gone too far.
Oh no,
yeah,
I got one for you.
I got one for you.
I just saw it injected on IMDb. The Attack of the Lederhosen Zombies.
Wow.
I'm not joking. That's not a joke.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, with horror, they all go in cycles, and like vampires and serial killers and zombies, they go in vogue and out of vogue, and something re-energizes them, and, you know, it just keeps going.
Yeah. And I actually seen this one. This is not a joke, Carl thing. It was called, "Oh my fucking God, it's another zombie movie?"
Nice. Yeah, they're you know. Well, go ahead, Stephen. Don't worry about it.
No, go ahead, Carl.
Well, I was just saying, does George Romero really know what he wrought? Seriously. Who would have guessed the overabundance of zombies? I mean, listen, if you just take all those movies and make those zombies real, we're dead. Is the zombies have overpopulated the earth?
Oh, he did, because call. They asked him about The Walking Dead, the series.
Oh,
before he died. And he said, and I quote, "I've already done that shit back in the 80s. Why would I want to do it again?"
Well, he did a few more, though, didn't he?
Calling it a soap opera with zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Document of the Dead. He returned with Land of the Dead and Survival of the Dead. I think he did a whole other
The only one that came out after The Walking Dead is the one that we like to say don't exist.
Survival.
Survival of the Dead don't exist.
Didn't like that one, huh? I saw it, and I thought it was okay. I mean, I understand. I think, of course, his budgets got really low, but he was still having a good time doing it and trying to, you know, kind of try to do his best under the circumstances. I think that one was shot somewhere very odd, too. And it was kind of an odd concept because he was really trying to do a rest. It was kind of like a mixed match of strange ideas and no money. And I know he experimented with, he was like a big proponent of CGI gore when he did that. He was like, "Hey, it's a lot easier just shooting this and then that, the blood flashing later on the computer." And of course, everybody's really divided on that. Most horror fans don't appreciate
it. Well, that was
CGI gore.
In an interview right before he dies, he said the reason he keeps making zombie films is that's the only thing people give him money for.
Yeah, it's very true. Like I said,
because he was trying to get a version of Stephen King's The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon in the production.
Right. And that was just kind of a, I remember reading the book. It wasn't really horror, but it was like kind of a fantasy type of dramatic.
Yeah, a little girl gets lost in the woods and has to find her way out.
Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't something that, I'm surprised they haven't made it yet, but just because everything Stephen King gets made 5 or 6 times, it's just, there's a few pieces of his that obviously, you know, the translation's going to be tough. I thought Gerald's Game was, it's an excellent novel, and I thought, the Netflix movie came out phenomenal, so that was a pretty good one recently.
Well, it's like my complaint about Cujo. Reading 300 pages of a woman locked in a car with a rabid dog outside is one of the most boring experiences of your life. Watching a 90-minute movie is the same thing. That's pretty damn fun and good.
Yeah, it's all about the editing.
No, it's just the visual. It's just some ideas are visual and some are better in books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like it's been, of course, remade in 2 movies. The next one's coming up in 2019 here. And, it was a mini series. And, it's an excellent book, I thought. I've read that a couple times.
Well, I did like the remake of it. And then, of course, they're doing the sequel to it. I did like that. I thought he did a really good job with that.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
It is one of those books you cannot literally translate it, because the way the time swing back and forth in the book, that would confuse the hell out of the audience.
Right. Well, that's what in the movies, the newer movies, they just kind of split it in half, and the first one is just the little kids when they're little, and then the next one's going to be when they're adults. So I think they tried to make it simpler as opposed to going back and forth. But again, a lot of it's just kind of viewer perspective and, what a person likes, doesn't like. So, and that's, again, something you can never predict. You can't predict what's going to sell well or do well or make $100 million or older movies that are restored. If they're going to sell well and get the whole thing back to Tempe, I think they probably sold about as many. I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I would say that sales were like, it hit feeling since they were. I don't think they did many Blu-rays, except for the specialty ones that JR would do, Indiegogo thing. So I mean, I think a lot of their catalog was on analog video, like my older stuff. So it's really, you know, unless you're just putting it on the format so to kind of archive it and have people have it on that disc, there's really not going to be much reason for, you know, people to upgrade, because you can't upgrade it. And, you know, everybody that loves that era has got those DVDs. You know, there's nowhere to go at a certain point on the older stuff. So,
yeah, like the only stuff, thing.
Go ahead.
The only thing I could see you doing with the Truth or Dare is, on Blu-ray, is like putting all of the films on like two or three Blu-rays and just making it easier to store for people.
Right, like a box, little mini box set or something.
Yeah.
You know, repackaging is
some
the way
films
to
like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like there's some movies from the 80s where, well, it's like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. When it first came out on DVD and stuff, it looked so beautiful that it looked fake.
Yeah, sometimes.
So they had to keep adding grain back.
Yeah, have you noticed, though, that some of these Blu-ray transfers, they try so hard to make it look better that on the monitor sometimes it's almost like, not only can you see the grain, it's distracting to the point where it's almost a fuzzy picture, like a VHF picture coming through an antenna screen, on, you know, depending on the film stock and the way they've transferred it and everything. And sometimes the colors are off and the blacks are too bright. And I'm like going, you know, I actually like the original DVD transfer much better than this, because it looks like a B-movie and not like something they're trying to make look perfect and ruining many of the scenes. And you can look at a lot of different movies, bigger ones like Jaws and Nighthawks, like that, where certain scenes, it just because of the film stock and the way they did the transfer, it's just like the picture looks horrible, even on, you know, like 4K, you know, whatever. So you're like, all this technology, we might.
I have seen a print of Evil Dead that looks so good, Tim. That, you know, the scene where he's kicking his sister to knock her back down into the cellar?
Yeah.
You can see there's a head on the stick, and you can see Sam Raimi down in the basement hole holding the stick.
Wow. So, yeah, see, they got the color timing wrong or something. And you know, they're revealing
the flaws
of the movie.
It was that bright and shiny and polished.
See, a lot of that can happen when they kind of overdo it, which is interesting.
And like one
of
Carl's
favorite
movies, how bad did Friedkin screw up the color timing in The French Connection?
Oh,
well, is it on the new one, Pete?
Yeah.
I haven't seen the. Is there a Blu-ray of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have not
seen
that.
It's not good, I'll tell you that. Yeah, you know, there's something about, you know, you got to let a piece of film or art just be the way it is. You know,
right.
You know, you have these filmmakers, I want to touch this up, I want to do that, I want to do this. No! Just leave it there. Never mind.
Definitely.
I'm done now.
Yeah. There's a lot of the guys like Ringo Lam, who died this week, the 90s Hong Kong directors that have purposely made the movies grainy and look a little blurry in scenes to try to hide the wires.
Right.
Who are pissed off that they're cleaning up the movie so much that you can actually see the stuff.
You see the wires.
That they worked hours and hours on, they try to hide.
Yeah. That does seem to happen with technology. It's not archiving the product the way it was. It's trying to archive and improve and bring it up to today's standards, which in a lot of cases, you know, may or may not. It's subjective. Maybe the filmmaker has a view. Maybe.
But you know, there's a difference between restoring a film and restoring a painting.
Right.
Okay, you already have it there. Okay, and you want to keep the physical part of that the way it's supposed to be. Well, you know, my feeling is that film, though it can be improved and that sort of thing, it's like a painting. It should be the way it was.
Right.
Okay? And you should do the restoration to keep it the way it was and is.
Right.
As opposed to improving it. Quote.
Like when Phantasm got remastered, the one thing that Coscarelli said he was happiest about was that he was able to fix the spear so when it flies across the screen and goes to hit the guy in the overalls, you can't see the camera crew reflected in it anymore.
Which I never noticed, and I've seen that movie probably 50 times. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love that film.
Well, you know why? Then that's the thing only a filmmaker would see that made the movie.
Right.
That's the point. That's the point. Because 90% of the audience, or 99% of the audience, isn't going to see that.
No.
We're not going to see that. We don't care to see that. It's not what we're focusing on.
Unless you just accidentally froze it at that point to go get popcorn or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, look.
Yeah.
But I would think that was cool. I'd be like going, wow, these guys make mistakes like me. You know, to me,
yeah,
leave it in there.
And then we got the other part of young generation that thinks, oh, movies should look like grainy crap because that's how I first seen them on VHS. No.
Tenth generation.
Does that insult you in a way, Tim, that there's a whole generation that think that guys like you who made low-budget films worked your ass off to make your film look like grainy crap with marks all over it?
Yeah, it's kind of amusing. Actually, I tried not to have it look like that, but in the old days, especially if you're shooting on video, you know, you would lose a lot just going down a generation, unlike today's, you know, digital movies. Even going from 3/4 inch to, you know, VHS, you were way down because, you know, VHS was like, what, 300 or 250 lines of resolution or 340 or something really low.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's going to look like video now.
And yet, I'll tell you something. When they did the remastering, when Massacre Video did the remastering of Chester Novell's Turner's Black Devil doll, they worked from his VHS master. And, you know, it looks like a VHS tape. And that's fine. I don't have a problem
with
that.
Yep, can't make it what it is.
It just seems like a lot of people love film, but they don't understand it.
It could be. I mean, it's like, I guess it just depends on how in-depth somebody gets with extras and making of books and interviews and, you know, the mechanics of, you know, making movies, the artists behind them all. And if you don't really get into all that, you're not going to much. And these days, not, you know, more and more people are kind of just taking it for granted. They're like not watching the extras like they used to. And again, it's more of a kind of a niche market. And I know a lot of people who really love my movies, really got into them. And, you know, when they came out and saw them, they don't watch as much anymore because, you know, they're out making their own movies. It inspired them enough to go do their own thing. So, no, you got people like that, and then you got the casual viewer who may look at it and go, man, I could do better with that with, you know, my iPhone here. I'm not watching this. And, you know, they don't understand anything that you tried to do, you know, with it. So there's kind of two sides to it, the ones that are looking for all of it and the other people who are, like, very casual about it, you know.
Well, you know what interests me Of course, Steven Soderbergh just did Unsane. He did it on an iPhone. And Quentin Depew and Rubber. I'm surprised I've not seen more of that.
Yeah.
That's because, have you seen any of Unsane, Carl?
No, I have not. But I have seen
it
Rubber.
Looks
that
like
was on
a
iPhone.
Yeah,
Rubber
but Unsane looks like a shitty, over-color saturated 8mm film. It looks horrible.
But you know what? Even if something looks horrible, you can use that in terminology, set something back in the 60s and say it's 8mm film, you know, and do a found footage or something. You could use it if you know how to use it and make it. And I'm sure as we go along, the technology is going to get better and better, that the iPhone cameras are going to be better and better, and it's going to look good. Trust me, they're working on it.
Oh, you can pick up a $300 video camera at Walmart nowadays, and it looks great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we shot Truth or Dare 5 with. I mean, we just used like really nice $300 Canon still cameras that happen to have also video on it, but with the lenses and everything, you get to change them. And if you, you know, change your, you know, colors and your and you watch your focus and you do all the things that are you know cinematic and not just leave it all on auto. You know, we got looks, you know, the picture and most of the scenes looks really, 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 really good. So it's all available.
Good stuff.
Yeah, but the thing is that most of them nowadays, they watch these crappy movies and kids and they want to make their own crappy movies. You can't make a crappy movie on purpose.
A lot of people try, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, probably the best movies are ones that are... I mean, if you're trying to do camp deliberately, I try to do the best that I can. If it comes out camp, then that's fine because it's an accidental thing and people are going to enjoy it more. But if you actually try to go out of your way to do it wrong to begin with and imitate, say, Ed Wood or whatever, it's just usually it doesn't work so good, you know.
You know, there are exceptions. You know, if you were trying to do a film like a 50s sci-fi film, you know, Lost Skeleton, The Cadaver, for example, or that, and you understand, you know, the humor and that it's a parody and so on and so forth, then that might work.
Right. Yeah, you're actually like
you have to be smart about it.
Saluting it.
You know?
Yeah, if you're doing a homage or saluting it, that's different. But if you're really just trying to go out and deliberately horrible in hopes that it's going to be loved because it's horrible, it usually doesn't work. I guess sometimes.
Yeah.
Damn. Are you still there?
But yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Tim?
Uh-huh.
Oh, there he is.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, he's still here. Oh, we bored him to sleep already.
No, I said a few things. Maybe it just didn't come across or something.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it was a wild time when you seen all these guys that had unique ideas, like you with Truth or Dare and stuff, able to make their movies and be able to sell them across the United States. And the video stores were dying for that stuff because, well, Boyd says the best. Starvation is always the best thing for an independent filmmaker when the outlets are starving for product.
That is true. I mean, was a different era where new material was kind of you know, they were screaming for, because at that point, in, you know, in the early 80s and even to like 1988 or so, not everything was out. So there was, you know, a need for re-releases. There was a need for, you know, I managed a little mom and pop store for like 3 or 4 years in the late 80s and early 90s. And, you know, the most common question was, what's good and new that I haven't seen before? And I would always try to steer on something. Customer, not to something necessarily new, unless it was, you know, really up their alley, but also to just something they hadn't seen before. And that's where, you know, like you said, you know, where there was like a big void, and you could get something like homegrown movies, do-it-yourself movies, independent movies, older classics, you know, that they may have missed if they were released, and that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, well, Chester Novel Turner told this story. You remember this, Carl, where he walked into a video store in an urban neighborhood, and said, he's like, I got a movie for sale. He's like, does it have black actors? Yes. Was it filmed by blacks? Yes. I'll buy 5 copies of each.
That's what they were looking for, you know. I mean, if there is a niche, or it becomes demographics. Like different blockbusters would carry, some of them would carry more obscure horror movies, especially if they were able to buy those and not corporate. If they're in an area where their customers preferred that sort of thing, and whereas other areas where there's different people that preferred something else, you know, they wouldn't buy those kind of movies. So.
And what we haven't talked about is in the 90s is when the majors noticed what you guys were doing, and they're like, hey, I want their market. So you seen Warner Brothers, Paramount, and them start their own DTV thing.
Exactly.
And 2 O'Clock Hero got saved because of that. Right, Carl?
That's true.
Okay, say that again.
Larry Doyne got a blank. What, Carl?
Go ahead.
But Larry Coyne got a blank contract from Warner Brothers to make 3 movies, as long as one of them was the It's Alive sequel. And Monty Hellman got Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, and he did his own film, The Toymaker, which the guys from Silent Night, Deadly Night bought and put as part of the series.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yep. You know, but unfortunately, when the studio started doing that, they're taking away your market. And that hurt you and the independents. And that's unfortunate.
Right. Well, it's the old adage, you either join up with them or you just continue struggling. And even though we did get to work with the studios sometimes, you know, it wasn't long, and they find themselves kind of on the outs. I mean, like if you look at David Cronenberg, you know, he continued to make really strange movies. Now, granted, a lot of them weren't really horror, but he made some really cool films like History of Violence. I thought that one was really cool. And then he went into making more obscure movies, and these were kind of studio movies, but when they didn't make any money, you know, he's at the point now where he's like, I can't get anything going. Same with John Waters. You're only as good as your last profitable studio movie, and he's been unable to get anything off the ground for years and years.
So of course, they're doing different things. Cronenberg
right.
just wrote a novel, and he's got a contract now for 2 more. And John Waters going around doing his lecturing and that sort of thing. So you find another outlet.
Right.
It's
that's
not
what you
got to do.
Yeah, it gets difficult in order to stay creative and keep, you know, if you need money, then you got to do, you know, other things. So.
Yeah, that's always the problem of finance versus art.
Right. Well, the independent scene now, as opposed to when I was doing it in the 80s and even in the early 90s a little bit, has become pretty much a social media thing where you go to Indiegogo or Kickstarter and you go directly to your fans and they finance it. And that's really the only way most people are getting. And some people are doing very well at it, and some people are doing okay at it. You know, they're getting enough to maybe get by, and some people are hardly getting anything, you know, with going that route. But that's really what is fueling. Almost everything now has a Kickstarter or Indiegogo or both. You know, they'll make $1,000 with the first campaign. They'll do six more of them. You know, pre-production. You're like going, okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's very various degrees of success, and it really depends on how popular the director is and what the actor, you know, who you got in your movie, how excited that people, you know, if you have fans, so. And really, if you make one that doesn't deliver, like through an Indiegogo type of thing, it really gets more and more difficult to kind of go back to the till and say, hey, we're going to do another one. So if you screw up, it's really difficult to, you know, it's the same as working for the studios and going, oh, okay, this last movie wasn't too profitable. But now you're doing it directly with your fans, and, hey, you didn't deliver, and they're like, you know, I'm not gonna donate $5 to that. I hated the last one. So you gotta be really careful.
Hell yeah.
And then there's the whole thing of like,
Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I know like Dario Argento had a fundraiser, and he never even finished the movie. You know? Never started it. So I mean, they had like $1 million raised. So.
Yeah. No, but
the craziest thing I've seen was if you donated I forget the movie, but if you donated $1,000 to the production, you would get a private nude webcam show with the main lead actress of the film.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've seen a few like that. That's pretty wild. Now, I wonder what would happen in that webcam. Is it just a conversation, or what happened?
Yeah.
You know, maybe
they probably pulled like a good David Friedman from back in the days where they'd sell the sizzle. You're getting 1 hour nude with her. She's going to be nude, and then all she does is talk to you for an hour and sets in a way where you can't see none of her nude body. You just got to take her word for it.
That's right. It'd be. We're from the neck up.
Yeah.
But then again,
I am not wearing anything. Let your imagination work. I know you gave us $1,000. Just imagine what you're not seeing.
Yeah, this is true. But you know, one thing I did want to mention was that there are, you know, Indiegogo campaigns that I remember seeing this one and going, oh, yeah. Yeah, I if I had money, I would put it in. And that was Spike Lee's Indiegogo for The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Right.
Yeah, but no one knew what it was during the Indiegogo.
What? Say that again, Steve?
No one knew what movie it was during the Indiegogo. He didn't even put the name of what movie he was doing.
Right. But then it came out, it was going to be a remake of Ganja and Hess.
Yeah.
If I remember, you saw that and you said, oh, holy shit, I paid for that. I remember you saying that to me.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's like Spike Lee's in Indiegogo, what's wrong with them? I'm doing a remake of Ganja and Hess, a gay vampire with religious and drug subtext in the 70s. Oh, okay, now I understand why he's having to do it.
You know, that one I get.
Yeah.
You want to do something that obscure? I get it.
Financed his last two films to Indiegogo, and I think his third one too, this Psycho Magic thing.
Who did that? Rob Zombie?
Jodorowsky.
Oh, okay. I know Rob Zombie did 31 through Indiegogo, part of the budget, and did quite well on it.
Yeah. And I feel sorry for anyone who paid for that one.
I've not seen it, so it's not good.
Well, the guy that plays Doomhead, and he's in Mandy too, playing the chemist, he's great.
Honestly, okay, and there's Malcolm McDowell. Okay, there's Malcolm McDowell, so that's always good.
Well, he doesn't do anything in the movie except stand around in a big fancy wig and throw coins in a pot. Literally, Carl.
I'm okay with that. I'm fine with that. It's Malcolm McDowell. Fuck it.
But basically, the whole movie is they're trapped in this place that looked like it was built for 10 cents. Running away from these guys in clown makeup trying to kill them.
Yeah, I think I have a copy of it somewhere. I'm going to have to check it out.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked a lot most of Rob Zombie's movies. I mean, I thought his take on Halloween was not Carpenter's, was definitely not as good as, but, I mean, I enjoyed it. The remake. And even part two, I had a pretty good time with it. I mean, it went right into the remake of a Halloween 2 in the hospital, and then it veered sharply to the right with all kinds of weirdness and stuff. And I mean, it kept my attention. So most people absolutely hate the second one, and they're kind of lukewarm or worse on the on the first one. But
well, don't forget, this is one of my most used insults. People want an entirely new sequel, but they want it to be the exact same damn film they've seen before.
Right. That's hard to do. It's hard to do. It's all new, but it's the same.
Yeah, all new. The characters you love and remember doing the things you know they do that you love and remember. All right.
Well, I mean, I think that probably goes back to the Halloween sequels and the Friday, especially the Friday the 13th. I mean, there was no effort made to not blueprint the previous one from 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, 5 had a small detour, but I mean, every one of them is exactly the same. And, you know, I went to every one of them and loved them. So it's like by the time Jason got to New York, you were like going, if he goes to space, I'm not going to like it as much because I'd rather have something new but exactly the same, but, you know, in Camp Crystal Lake.
Hey, Jason X had Jason kill David Cronenberg. That's a plus.
Yeah, at the beginning, that was pretty cool. But no, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's always Leprechaun in the hood. Okay, I mean, they get too silly.
Yeah, at least Jason never went to the hood, right? Yet.
Don't give him any ideas.
Jason goes to the hood. Jason goes to Detroit.
Jason goes to the disco.
Yeah, there we go.
No, that would be the one Jason would be afraid of. And I'm thinking of the part in Kentucky Fried movie. Cut off this man's head. I'm not afraid of that. Okay, send him to Detroit. No, God, no, not that.
That could be good.
Because that was the only really good part of that one Jason goes to takes Manhattan. Is when he walks past the punks and kicks their radio, and they pull their knives on him, and he whips his mask up. Yeah. 5 seconds of a 90-minute movie that shows what they should have done.
Yeah. Like, should have been kind of.
Just imagine that, Carl. Jason in Alphabet City.
Nice.
Jason takes the Love Boat was what it was, more like it.
Yeah,
that was my hangout in the 80s with the East Village and Alphabet City. So, low rent, trust me. I love my low rent New York.
Okay, it's 26 minutes, and we're going to call it a night here. Thank you for showing up again, Tim. Really, if you...
No problem.
Is Truth or Dare on Amazon now?
Truth or Dare 5. The latest one is part 5 is on Amazon. distributed through Gator Blade Films, and it's doing very well. So if you're interested in that, and then next year we've got High Death coming out. That should be out in like that's from Wild Eye Entertainment. That should be out probably late summer. And then we've got new shorts we're doing, and meeting up with Shannon Stockin, who's got all kinds of cool makeup effects and acting that are coming up in the future for 2019. So I've got a ton of things that should be coming out and in progress. We got like three shorts we're shooting now, and then we're going to do probably a feature in the summertime.
Yeah.
A lot
and thank
going
you
on.
For JR Book Walter and whatever the future is for Tempe Video. Thank you again for basically being one of the guys that taught us to be adventurous in the VHS days. Same to you,
yeah.
too. We were more adventurous back then.
It
I mean,
was
it was like
time,
truth
man.
Or dare. Truth or dare.
Dead
50 cent
store.
Rental. Okay, I'll risk it.
It
was easier
dead
to risk. Yeah. It's easier to risk your money on obscure Shaw video stuff in a video store that had it in the 50-cent rental part or just $1
right.
for 5 days.
Oh, really? I don't remember that. The ones I had like,
oh, yeah.
they were all
yeah,
pretty much across the board.
Absolutely.
Like three. It was like $3 down in Florida when I was going up on it. It was like,
yeah, well, the new ones were
yeah.
always $3.
Yeah.
I'm talking about
I didn't
the
know they had
titles.
Older sections that were. Yeah, I didn't ever see that. I must be either that or I got
yeah.
ripped off. They were always, yeah, of course, when they saw me coming, they knew I was always going to rent something older and obscure. So why give this guy a discount?
Yeah.
Charge him the full $2.50 or $3.
But nowadays, you go into a theater, obscure movie that you don't know much about, but you might be interested in. $10! Sure thing.
Ten. It's
okay.
like $12.50 for a matinee. Well, let's think about this. Two people go to see a movie in the afternoon. It's going to be $25 to get in. And then if you buy a thing of popcorn, that's going to be, what, $15 with a Coke?
Yeah.
You're spending like $40. I'm like thinking, you know, I could have bought the Blu-ray twice.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's why you're more likely to go see a Sure Thing at the theater. Even though Carl likes art films, he would go for his Sure Thing film, right, Carl?
I'd still like to see an art film on a big screen. I would have loved to see November on a big screen, but you know, I'd go to the Avengers and stuff like that. Sure, I would.
No, I'm talking
money.
A sure film for you, Carl. Not just that. It's like November would be a sure film for you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was screaming about that a year ago when I first saw the trailer. Like, I have to see this.
But
yeah, I love
my yeah.
movies. I do.
And coming up tomorrow is the New Year's Eve Spectacular with me and the crew from the Deviant Legion, the good part of them's there, Doc and Vicky, and Carl's there too. And we're giving out tomorrow night the coveted Asshole of the Year award. This guy was such an asshole last year that he even beat out Trump. Listen to the show to find out who.
Fuck you.
Can I get my speech now for the award? I really
No, it would be me.
Oh, wait.
I did that award.
But I left the cat
yeah.
out of the bag there. Oh.
Yeah. And we're going to do our top tens. And right after that, at midnight on New Year's Eve, we'll be playing a live watch of Mandy. Yes, we're starting New Year's Eve here on KSD Radio with LSD, heavy metal, hippies, and just all sorts of weirdness. So join
Nicholas
us tomorrow
Cage.
Night. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Nicholas Cage.
Yeah, and I said
it
earlier while Stephen was out, but on Friday, this coming Friday after New Year's, I will be doing a show on Deviant Legion all about the wondrousness and the beautiness of cheese. Yes, we're going to be talking about all sorts of cheese, all sorts of debris, all sorts of puns on cheese, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So we're going to do that. And Tim, it's been a pleasure having you on and being here with you again. So just wanted to say that before we say goodnight.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And Sunday is Mike and Steve's Kung Fu / Spaghetti Western, and we're going to be doing the first Kung Fu hit that was a big hit over here. The one that started it all, that would be King Boxer / Five Fingers of Death. So join me and Mike as we watch that. And thank you. And thank you all for the year, listening to us throughout the year. Right, Carl?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been a blast.
And good night, everybody.
Good night.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit. Let receiver pressure increase. All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Well, Magneto's right. There's a war coming.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
You sure you're on the right side?